Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. My answers are posted every week on Mondays, and you can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask me, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Let's start today with a question about Ayn Rand's mental process. How is she able to depict so convincingly the inner life of evil people, such as Jim Taggart? How was she able to understand the mental state of the chronically out of focus and evasive? In a sense, of course, everyone can only know what they personally have experienced in the broad sense. If you had never experienced a certain category of emotion, just like of a certain category of color, you could not project it just out of a void. But what you can do, if you have any element of a certain category, is abstract and from its distinct surroundings, and then imagine it in different quantity, in different contexts. You can project what a person would be if that quality, as you experience it, became dominant. Now, take as an example first, could Ayn Rand depict a character who was neurotically anxious? In other words, anxious and fearful all the time that something awful would happen, but without any basis. That's a neurotic anxiety. Yes, she certainly could, not because she experienced it, but because she has experienced anxiety. For instance, if her husband is out and he's not back when expected, and that's untypical of him, she experiences anxiety. So if she knows that emotion, all she has to do as a thinker is ignore the fact of its cause and project it as being continual, metaphysical. And then she is able to grasp without any problem and write about. Now, if she were concrete bound, then if she didn't experience specifically neurotic anxiety, she couldn't. But anyone who with a conceptual capacity can imagine a quality changed in degree, in context, with a different causal situation, and can easily depict it. Now, one of the questions is, how about a person being chronically evasive? Well, of course, chronically is just a projection of any time a person is evasive or wants something above reality. And everyone, Ayn Rand and her heroes included, know that such a situation, have experienced such a situation, and know that the power of consciousness includes the potentiality of not looking at reality. Now, an example, for instance, in real life, not in real life, but in Atlas, was John Galt, for a moment, dropping the context and focusing on what he wanted as represented by Reardon as against reality. Now, he didn't give in to that, but he certainly had the temptation for a moment to give in to it, and that is enough for Galt to be able to grasp what it would be like if one succumbed to that kind of temptation. Now, did Ayn Rand ever have that? Well, on certain minor things, yes, She did. For instance, she did not like to get her hair done or to discuss legal contracts. And in many cases, she would be tempted not to do it or to say, I'll do it tomorrow. But she would then, having got that temptation, realize, if it were so in a given situation, that this is reality. She has to do it. She's appearing on TV or whatever. So she would then resist that temptation. Everyone who has free will knows that inherent in choosing to think, a certain effort is required, and that it's possible not to exert that effort and even to look away from the requirement for that effort. That doesn't mean you ever have to do something immoral to grasp the possibility. Now, for example, Ayn Rand is a staunch advocate of a benevolent universe. She does not believe that man is doomed to failure. And yet she projected very realistically the character Dominique in The Fountainhead, who was very bitter and believed that values can't succeed in this world. Well, where did she get such a possibility? And her answer was, Dominique is myself in a bad mood. In other words, in a bad mood, she has an indication of the feeling it's hopeless. She doesn't believe it, but it comes to her because in that context, only the negatives become real. She doesn't act on it or write that way, but she has that experience. And just having that mood is enough for her to project a whole human being motivated by that mood. So how all these negatives are capable of being experienced in some form, in some moral form, by anybody, including a perfectly moral person. More broadly, a writer of any intelligence and abstract capacity can project the most huge development that he has never experienced from a very small beginning. And the perfect example here is Tolstoy. Leo Tolstoy, the Russian author, was asked, you've never been in a war, you've never seen the French and the Russians in the battlefield. How could you possibly convey so eloquently in War and Peace this gigantic thing of which you have no knowledge? And Tolstoy gave a perfect, perfect answer. He said, I saw a street fight once. That's all he needed to project the Napoleonic Wars. Now, here's a question. Why don't you offer as an option a $20 question box? So if someone wants to pay $20 to get an answer, doesn't that mean more than the average question that comes in? I have $200 worth of questions. Well, I get this several times. You're an objectivist, so why aren't you charging? And I have to repeat that my goal is not money. By the way, why would you think that if it were money, you could have me for $20 a question? I don't want to boast, but I've been offered a lot more than that. But in any event, you're wrong to think that if you want to pay 20, you will submit better questions than poor people who can't afford 20 or who won't give 20. And that, in my experience, is absolutely not true. I've had many cases of very wealthy people ask much dumber questions than very poor students. So I'm just leaving out, in addition to the basic motivation, what this $20 is going to cost me in terms of the accountancy and who keeps track of the income and what hotel do I put the IRS agent that's auditing me and what about all the time in my life, which I consider the most precious commodity, devoted to overseeing this business. I don't want to go into business. The whole idea of this, it's in a few minutes here and there without being, you know, committed to trying to become a competitor of Harvard. So the money I would make if I charge your price or even 10 times that price were causing me so much grief that I would end up paying it to a psychiatrist or a cardiologist. Now we get the other side. One side is opposed because I don't charge, and now listen to this question. If saving the culture is so important, why does the Ayn Rand bookstore not offer its material for free? Denying accessibility to crucial ideas could make the difference between winning and losing. So you see, I'm damned if I don't charge, and I'm damned if I do charge, so you can't win. Now let's say then, all objectivist works are given away free. Well, there's a lot of cost to produce those works. What happens to the people who produce them, who spent the time, to the staff, the paper, the rent, etc., etc.? And fundamentally, beneath that, what happens to the reward for the people that did the time and did the work? Are they supposed to sacrifice so that the culture as a whole is doing better? In other words, the culture as a whole, as presented in this question, is helpless and cannot be saved. The only means it can have to be saved is if the people who know the truth give the answers to the culture. So the idea is the culture should benefit because it doesn't know, at the price of those who do know being sacrificed. They are to become serfs, and meanwhile, they're to become serfs while preaching egoism. They're to live in starvation conditions to explain to other people what's wrong with that, choosing that as a way of life. Saving the culture is a means, not an end. If you think that the culture's in a bad state and you think that you want to spend some of your time or all of your time on that, that's fine. But if you don't think that, or your time is 100% taken up with your own profession, then that's not an end that concerns you. And if you're prepared to say, I want to spend 100% of the time on my work, if I get blown up when the culture goes, I'll live with that. That is your prerogative. But there is no such thing as an egoistic crusader who says, I want only spiritual rewards. I want only to benefit others and save the world. Completely, completely unjustified. So objectivists are justified in charging, but sometimes there's a case where they'd rather not. I hope you can tolerate that. It is not a contradiction. Now a very different question. My last name is rather unique. Now, he doesn't want me to give the name, but it's like, it's a synonym for caring or passion. It's an abstract quality, a good one. I was wondering if in the future I were to marry, is it rational to worry about my last name being lost to history if I were to take my husband's name? My answer is, why do you care whether your name is lost to history or not? The concept, you know, your name, already exists, and you will be gone, but the concept will not be lost. It is not an achievement of yours. It's an accident that somebody attached that tag to you. So, and even if we didn't have that name, if it's a concept, it'll be rediscovered. There's no value in the name going on just because it's yours. Now, you know, there are people that put a value in leaving behind something that will live after they die, their works or their children or whatever. I do not see the logic of that. For instance, it's common in many Asian societies for the man to feel he must have a boy because the boy will carry his name on. Now, this to me is complete tribalism, the tribalism of the family. I get my identity through my belonging to the tribe, and if my son keeps going, then the tribe as a whole keeps going. That is a completely non-individualistic and non-rational approach. Your attitude should be, after you're dead, you're dead. And nothing of value to you can happen once you are dead. And that includes whatever remains of you and whatever happens to it. So to consider as a factor in your life, worrying about something that you valued in this case dubiously, in my opinion, worried about it surviving you is completely unjustified. If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peikoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Thanks for listening.